This is KAZU General Manager Mick Benedict, and I'm joined in the studio by Cal State Monterey Bay President Dr. Eduardo Ochoa. We're here to introduce the second presentation of this year's Cal State Monterey Bay President Speaker Series, featuring guest speaker Sebastian Thrune, professor of computer science and electrical engineering at Stanford and co-founder of Udacity.com. Before we introduce Professor Thrune, I wanted to take this opportunity to ask Cal State Monterey Bay President Dr. Ochoa why he chose disruptive innovation in higher education as this year's topic for the President's Speaker Series.
Well, coming back from Washington after working in the Obama administration, I became very aware of the new emerging trends in technology and in pedagogy that are impacting higher education. And these innovations are disruptive because they have the potential for completely transforming the cost structure of higher education while delivering quality education. And our universities, based on brick and mortar and high fixed costs, need to take into account these disruptive innovations to see what our response is going to be to make sure that we're around for the next century.
President Ochoa, of the many questions that these innovations may lead to, how do you see massive online courses or MOOCs affecting the traditional campus setting and experience for students?
Well, MOOCs, or massively open online courses, have in fact grabbed the headlines across the country and have driven some governing boards to distraction, most notably at the University of Virginia, where a board very concerned that their university wasn't moving fast enough fired the president of the university for a few weeks until there was an outcry by the campus community and others that made them reverse that decision. So it is something that is causing quite a bit of turmoil, and it could well be one of those disruptive innovations. So we have to take into account how we're going to respond to this new technology. San Jose State, in fact, and the CSU has developed a partnership with Udacity where they're testing MOOCs as an element in what we call flipped classrooms, where basically the lecturer is moved out of the classroom to an online environment for students to go through on their own. And the classroom is then used for interactive work where the faculty member is more of a mentor or coach than a lecturer.
Do you see the amount of students that may in the future be on a campus or in dorms diminishing or staying the same? And how will students interact with each other if they're taking classes online?
Well, we have to distinguish here between online as a delivery mechanism and innovations using technology that actually transform the very way that we do teaching and learning. Those are two different things. We've been doing online for a couple of decades now, but up until now, it has been basically making virtually what we had been doing in the classroom in the past. And that primarily was not to reduce costs, but to provide access to people who were too far away from the campus to be able to reach it conveniently, or just to add more convenience to people that could come to campus occasionally. But what we're seeing now is really technology being used to transform qualitatively how we do things in teaching and learning. Understanding how the brain works leads to different pedagogies. Big data analytics allows us to see how students are responding in a variety of ways to their efforts at learning, and then we can start modifying our pedagogy and make it science-based, which it hadn't been in the past.
In just a few minutes, we'll hear guest speaker Sebastian Thrune, co-founder of Udacity.com, where he taught an online course to over 160,000 students in more than 190 countries. President Ochoa, can you tell us why Professor Thrune is on the cutting edge of this new and innovative concept in higher education?
Well, it's really quite amazing that with the spread of the internet, universities are finding that by putting their courses online, they can reach a vast global audience. So this is really has the potential to transform our world, because knowledge and information now knows no boundaries and is seamlessly available to all across the globe. But for us specifically, it's also holds the promise of actually significantly lowering the cost of education and raising the capacity of our universities to educate more students in the U.S. So that's the great promise and excitement for us of the Udacity experiment.
Now here is the guest speaker of Cal State Monterey Bay President Speaker Series, Sebastian Thrune.
Thank you so much. It's a great pleasure being here.
And
thanks for taking the afternoon. To attend my talk. First of all, I want to express my apologies if you followed the media and learned about MOOCs and felt that we are on shaking grounds. That was never my intention. My intention is really to help and assist. But I also want to express my appreciation for what you and faculty are actually doing here in the CSU system and in Monterey Bay. It's great to see so much dedication among all of you to really help the youth of this country to become more powerful and more successful. And that's exactly what I, as a lifelong educator, have dedicated my life to as well. Now, paths of life are somewhat mysterious, and things happen that you don't plan for. And that happened to me about a year and a half ago. I attended a conference called TED, where a young fellow named Salman Khan gave a talk. I see some of you have crossed that name before. Sal is one of my heroes. He, at the time when his work started 6 years ago, was a hedge fund analyst and had nothing to do with education, except he had two nieces, and those two nieces he taught math. And at some point, when he was traveling and trying to explain them a concept, he realized he wouldn't be able to be there in time, and instead recorded himself on YouTube so that the nieces could watch his explanation on YouTube. And two things changed that happened that changed his life. Number one, the nieces told him they actually preferred him on YouTube over him in person. And the reason was they could rewind him and see him and watch him again. And you know what? Watch him in their underpants in the privacy of the bedroom. It's a big deal. And secondly, it wasn't just his two nieces that started watching him, but at the time he gave his TED talk, tens of millions of other students who liked his explanations. And that led to possibly the most important revolution in K-12 to this date. I would think of Sal Khan as the single most influential educator that we have right now in this country. That's quite remarkable for someone who doesn't have a PhD in education or never wanted to be an educator. It's one of these stories, I think, of American ingenuity where different thinking, different background, all of a sudden, and an ounce of good luck and surprise lead to solutions that no one ever anticipated. And Sal has been, of course, tirelessly innovating since, proving that C-level math students can make it to A-level if they're just given the opportunity to progress at their own speed. Now, I heard this in the audience, and at the time, I was teaching at Stanford, and I had a fairly successful class. It was a graduate level class in artificial intelligence, and typically 200 students would enroll, which by Stanford standards is a large number. And here was this guy, a hedge fund analyst, who would get 20 million students. So I felt I had to do something about my own class. So Peter Norvig and I, Peter is my good friend and buddy, a Google engineer, who teaches class together, got together and decided, let's put this class online. And we had no clue what that meant at the time. But to test the waters, we sent one email, and I'll show you the email. This is the entire email. In fact, this is my entire marketing campaign for my artificial intelligence class. And you shouldn't read it all. I'm going to just highlight one sentence for you. We told people it's free. It's online. You can sign up. We got a domain name, aiclass.org. And we give you the same exams and exercises as Stanford students, so you can compare yourself to Stanford students. Now, Peter and I took bets how many students we would get. And Peter would say 2,000, 3,000. And I was the outlier. I said 10,000 students. And I mean, at that time, there weren't classes that had 10,000 students. I mean, today it feels like completely natural and normal, and that's 10,000. But at the time, that didn't exist. So people looked at me and said, Sebastian, dream on. Now, that was on a Friday afternoon. Saturday morning when I woke up, there were 5,000 students signed up. Sunday morning, 10,000 students. Monday morning, when we were all over the blogosphere, how great Stanford was, finally opening up its sacred halls to the public, we had 14,000 students, which is when the administration figured out what it has done. I didn't expect anything like that. And I got a phone call from my dean saying, Sebastian, I said, Dean. So after a whole bunch of meetings, we agreed to continue and offer this class free of charge to the world. And two other Stanford faculty, Andrew Ng and Jennifer Widham, decided to also put their classes online that they had previously prepared for more like a close classroom use. Now, I was facing a problem. At the time, I was a Google VP, Stanford research professor, teaching my classes. I had basically two full-time jobs, and I had no technology, and I had to teach a class to 160,000 students. So obviously there was something missing. So we had to scramble together a technology platform within a few weeks and make a class that we could teach to 160,000 students. And if you're ever nervous about going to class because there's too many students, 160,000 is a large number, so it's a very high embarrassment factor. So Peter and I, here's Peter and me, scrambled in our basement and his house and my house to put together this class. And there was one thing that I really want to do differently, and we do differently today, and later I'll demonstrate to you so you can see the effect of it, is that I just never was inspired by the way online classes are built. What we do in a classroom is very different from what we can do online. In a classroom, we're forced to go at a fixed speed with our students. And if I pictured a stadium of 160,000 students, God forbid a stadium this size doesn't even exist, then the best I could do is just shout out my lecture. But I never felt it was the right way to learn. So what we decided to do is rather than recording our lectures, we recorded our exercises and made the class entirely around exercise and student experience. So here's a typical example in the middle of a class. This was literally done on a piece of paper, on a napkin, with a pen and a camcorder that my wife had given me for my birthday on a tripod. That's the origin of the MOOCs. And in this class, I really introduce concepts by question after question after question. This is a fairly evolved mathematical logics concept out of Bayes networks, which most of you will probably have no clue what it's talking about. You can take my class if you want to, if you care. But the key thing is we extended the video format from a pure passive viewing experience to one where the student gets engaged and has to answer questions. So the video screen that would explain the question would stop, freeze, and become have either little push buttons or numerical questions or textual questions. And then students would be able to venture their guesses. And then the system would give feedback whether these things are right or wrong. And then I would come as to a student's rescue and explain to them how I would solve the problem. So always student exercise first. We scrambled this together. Most of the recording occurred between 2 a.m. and 4 a.m. Most of my students in the huge discussion forum could tell how fatigued I was and how tired I looked. A lot of my headshots were taken on a mattress as opposed to in a studio, which they couldn't tell. My perspective doesn't really work in video very well. But we scratched it together and we made a full-blown class throughout the semester. The things that moved me were actually not the numbers. 160,000 sounds like a shockingly large number for any professor, but it's small compared to the world population. What really moved me the most were the testimonies and emails we received. So here's one, and I want to read a piece of you. And I got literally thousands of such emails. This is a fellow trooper, a soldier in Afghanistan, who sends me, I'm completing the course from remote areas of Afghanistan and often don't have great internet connectivity or electricity. I spent the last few days under incoming mortar and rocket attacks, then dodging checkpoints under questionable legal status to exfiltrate a war zone to a third world airfield until things settled down. I had about an hour of fairly solid internet connectivity to be able to get the assignments done and still manage a respectable score. This is a typical week here for me. That isn't your typical Stanford student. That's one of our troops putting their lives on the line every day for us and trying to develop a future past the battlefield. It was obvious to me the impact I was having on this one student whose entire hopes were centered now around my class, to the point that he would expose himself to extra life risk to get the assignments done in time and manage a respectable score, that impact was much higher than the impact I have on the typical Stanford student. I actually often told my students at Stanford, when they worry about what career to go into, what job to pick, and I always tell them, don't worry about it, the job will find you. Little did I understand that that job would find me through these emails. Here's a second example of a lady named Sabrina, who worked 40 plus hours a week. She was a single mother of two and a younger child only 7 months old. I have no time to concentrate or dedicate. I've still been hanging onto the class by my fingernails, wanting to learn and to feel a sense of accomplishment. Just before homework five was due, I suffered another series of great chaotic difficulties in my life. My job has been threatened by the economic climate. My personal life kind of exploded. I'm on my own with the children. The baby has been sick. A family member is suddenly sick. Another losing their home. The list goes on and on. Why am I telling you so much personal stuff? Because number 13, I gave up. She goes, more text. And then on Monday morning, this is great out here, I checked my email and I saw the note you sent Saturday. And I stared at it for a while, and then I sighed and told to myself, I can't quit now. I took the midterm this weekend, mostly while holding a teething infant. None of my other issues have gone away, but I feel more determined than ever to see this through for myself, because I want to, because it makes me feel good. Again, not your typical Stanford student. There's so many mothers and so many parents that went off the education and job path to raise children and coming to a point in their life where they asked the question, what's their self-value? What's their future? Here was able to touch somebody who would never get admitted into Stanford. This is very, very powerful to get emails like those. Now, this specific email I got because as the homeworks came along, I think it was about homework five, about 40,000 students had fallen behind. So I sent 40,000 personal emails to people that said, you're falling behind. One was to Sabrina, and I got maybe 8,000 replies back, most of which I wasn't able to read. They would tell me why they had fallen behind and what the resolution was. But I would make it a habit to read at least 50 or so every day, and many of these emails that I read had the same theme to it. Another set of emails really addressed shortcomings that we had. I had set up the course very much like a typical Stanford course. You got a one-time chance at your exam, and if you don't get it right, we just give you a bad grade. Lots, thousands of students complained and said, why on earth in the online age would you want to give us a bad grade? Why not just give us extra time and extra chances to finally get it right? And then there was a set of emails that really blew my mind. Students saying, this is the most intimate learning experience of my life. And I didn't get that this was possible. I always thought, if you're in a classroom of many students, how can this be intimate? 100, 200, 160,000. Mm-hmm. But the truth was, the student experience was not dissimilar from the way you experience a good movie or a video game. It didn't bother you that there were 160,000 other students watching it at about the same time. It would go at your own pace and would speak to you. You'd feel right next to me. There's a magic in this medium that I didn't expect existed, but that really changed students' lives. So we got thousands and thousands of students who said, best class ever in my life. Now that all made me believe, wow, there's something in here. We have to really dive deeper and see whether we can really make a difference in the way we educate students. And I went on a journey. I famously, about a year and a half ago, told the public that it'd be hard for me to go back and teach just 160 students. And I felt in the world of education, there's a choice to take a red pill or a blue pill. And you can take the blue pill and go back to your regular classroom. But I've taken the red pill, and I want to see how deep rabbit hole it is. And I've been in this process. The statistics of this class are really staggering. And this was just the first of our classes. We have since had much better classes. 160,000 students, 23,000 of them graduated. 1,950 people volunteered to translate this class into 44 languages. students from 195 countries took this course. We had more students in Lithuania than Stanford has students. When we finally stacked ranked all the students and looked at the comparison of the best Stanford students versus the best online students, the top 412 students were all online. And number 413 was the leading Stanford student. And the last number on this slide, 0.6, is the one that's really captured the media's attention, and I think sadly has captured the media's attention. That's the dollar amount per student that we had to pay for everything, including platform development and making the course. So it was less than a dollar per student. Now, let me step back a little bit and give you some perspective on education that is on many people's minds, especially if you're a student right now, it's probably on your mind. In the last 30 years, we had a sustained growth of college costs, tuition costs, educational expenses. The growth rate has been about 7.45% per year on average, outpacing every other field, including medical, housing, and of course, inflation. We've gotten to the point where the national debt in college tuition is $1 trillion. And that debt is unforgivable. If you have college debt, you won't be able to go through bankruptcy and get rid of it. This puts an unbelievable burden on the young generation. We are at the first time moving into a generation where the kids are less college educated than their parents on average. That's something we should really keep in mind, because I think we are on a path where the benefits of college education are being questioned, and we're getting to a point, an inflection point, where the confidence of students to go to college might actually be shaken. It's actually happening right now. And as a result, we might find that this might end up be feel like a bubble that bursts. I'm not saying this because I want to make everybody feel bad in education. I'm saying this because this is actually a fact, whether we like it or not. And now is a really great time to constructively think about how can we actually really help and avoid that at some point our higher education system will have a major setback. The company that I founded is called Udacity. We're one of the big three we're all small, I guess, in these massive open online courses or MOOCs. We have right now about 22 courses online, several with the CSU, which I'll talk about in a minute. We have about 1.2 million students in total. We have a whole bunch of partner companies. Those companies like Google and NVIDIA and Microsoft fund class development, but they also recruit some of our graduates. And we have about 45 people. Our mission at this point is twofold. We really care about driving pedagogy. This is the number one thing we care about, inventing a framework in online that really makes it possible to educate effectively. And that's the number one thing I care about at this point. I wouldn't claim that our original class did a great job with this. We can do much, much better. And also really rethink the cost of education and ask the question, as we go to scale, is there a path in there in which we can reach many more people, enhance access, and then also make this access available, the savings available back to the students, which is what we're doing with San Jose State. In pedagogy, and I'll give you a demonstration in a second, we take our motivation from fields of learning that might not be respectable among traditional educators, but I believe are really important to pay attention to. Most notably, video games. Let me take a show of hand. Who here knows what video game this is? Thank you. Pretty much everybody. Who here has played it? Who has played it for more than 10 hours? That's the embarrassment factor. I see hands go up and down very quickly. Interesting. I bet more than I just saw hands. Video games are really interesting animals in that they teach you something. Angry Bird teaches you about how birds in slingshots affect blocks and pigs. Not exactly PhD material at Stanford, but there's a notion of physics in there. There's a notion of problem solving. There's a notion of skill. Now, Angry Birds is not your classical lecture environment. It's very different. No one ever lectures you. You learn by doing with a curated sequence of problems. But assessment which we tend to dislike as a student in higher education, is your friend in Angry Birds. In fact, you crave to make it to the next level. You crave so much that at least one person for about a second admitted to have played more than 10 hours Angry Birds, even though you won't get college credit for Angry Birds. Now, why is that an interesting thing to look at? I'm not saying that Angry Birds is the solution for our higher education problem, not far removed. But drawing inspirations from fields that are counter to what we do today is always a good thing, and seeing if we can bring it in. In Angry Birds, your assessments are extremely frequent. You have as much time as you want. You can try as often as you want. And when you finally get it, you've really acquired the skill and you get a certain sense of pride. It almost acts like a drug. That's why people get sucked into video games, to go to the next level. What a beautiful learning method. If only we could design Angry Birds to get you all the way to a PhD in physics, then we had a fantastic approach to higher education. In Angry Birds, people want to learn. If you do video games, you want to learn. It turns out people do want to learn. It's a myth that students don't want to learn. So I want to give you a demonstration of how we take these inspirations into Udacity. And of course, we're not anywhere near as good in Angry Birds, but we're much more academic. We do classes that are really advanced all the way to upper-level master's degree classes, and of course also entry-level classes. And the demo I want to give you is, I want to actually really expose you to a typical Udacity class. And I don't want to just have you take the class, I also want you to see the making of the class. So let's see if this works. I'm going to unplug this for a second. So here's my Udacity course creator. And maybe I'll start with a little video. Oops, wrong camera, let's see. So again. Oh. Hi, I'm your professor, good seeing you. All right, nothing really happened. Okay, that's great video. We use it, okay, call it me. And now I want to go in and make a new lesson. And rather than teaching you something by lecturing you, I want you to experience problem solving. So I'm going to take a physics example. Let's call this, So this is my class on Physics 101. And I'm making this right now as you listen, okay? And I'm going to start with a little problem for you. You are on a lake. Inside a boat. Let's just make this the water here. Perfect. Maybe there's a fish in here, I don't know. Okay. And inside the boat is a heavy, heavy rock. So it's a rock. And now I'm going to take this rock and toss it over. Let's do this. You know, take this rock and toss it overboard, and the rock, just take it out, sorry. On this. Sinks straight to the ground. Okay, that's the story. It's a physics thing. Anybody here teaches physics? Ha, good. Awesome, you're gonna get it right. Oops. This again, thinner. So my question for you is, by doing so, has the water level relative to the shore gone up, stayed the same, or gone down? So this is certainly not the most pretty class I ever made in my life, but it's life, and so let me just show you what I just did. Hold on, I need to plug this in.
So this is my class on Physics 101. You are on a lake inside a boat. And inside the boat is a heavy, heavy rock. You now take this rock and toss it overboard, and the rock sinks straight to the ground. So my question for you is, by doing so, has the water level relative to the shore gone up, stayed the same, or gone down?
So water level, obviously I didn't speak very well. So that's kind of making of one of those, so really easy to make. And then I can turn them into quizzes. So let's make a question here. And this is going to be just a multiple choice. You either went up, stayed the same, or went down. So you can drag those guys. They can also drag other stuff there all the way to program code. But before I answer this, let me just ask you, okay, so you had this chance to think about this now. Has the water level, by dropping this heavy stone that goes all the way to the bottom, has the water level gone up, stayed the same, or gone down? Just to see, take a show of hands here. Who thinks it's gone up? About 6, 7 people, 8 people, 9 people. Stayed the same. Vast majority. Gone down. About 12 people or so. Is that correct? So what do the physics professors think? Gone down. Okay. Anyone changing your mind right now at this point? Professor has spoken. Okay. Let me just, before I give you the answer, explain to you what just happened. If I'm not mistaken, when you started thinking about this, you were being asked what the right answer is, your brain's engaged. Your brain's probably worked harder for the last 50 seconds than they've worked through the rest of the talk. That's what we're after, brain work. We think we can't lose exercise by watching, well, can't lose weight by watching another person exercise. I think you can't learn by watching another person solve problems. It's not entirely black and white, but by and large, we learn by solving problems ourselves. And this medium affords you this because you can take the time to do the right thing. Second thing I want to illustrate is there's a good number of you didn't raise your hands at all. Why is that? Well, in a big auditorium, it's very embarrassing to be wrong. In fact, when I ask the question, who does Angry Bird for more than 10 hours? I'm sure a good number of you have done this. It's like asking the drunk driving question, right? Or do you have a secret girlfriend-boyfriend question? If you don't raise their hands. It turns out learning is also a private matter. And we detest to be embarrassed in front of others showing we get it wrong and we don't know the right thing. And it's very common that people don't raise their hand at all just because they're too afraid of being embarrassed. And we know this from students in the class. Whereas in this private medium, it's perfectly fine to be wrong. No one knows. So there's a lot of things you can do online that you could not really do in a classroom very well, and that this medium captures. Let's see, let me just take another show of hands. Who says has gone up? Okay, about 8 or 9 people. Say the same. Okay, fewer, gone down. I see, so a little bit more. So the authority of a physics professor clearly adds to the solution. Now I could make the next unit by which I would then show you that when you take a bucket of water and you add a rock to this bucket, the volume goes up, but only in proportion to the volume of the rock. But if I go and, do the same with the vessel inside, like this one, then this rock doesn't just displace its volume because it's a heavy rock, it also replaces additional air. I'm not good at speaking and drawing at the same time. Additional air, which is the area over here, related to its weight. And since it's a rock that is very heavy, it ends up displacing more. So it means before the rock was, when the rock was in the boat, the water level must have been higher than after it sank to the ground, and the physics professor was correct. Congratulations. That is actually really good, I think. So when you dive in and look at the classes, we have 22 or so online. We're not the biggest, but we put a lot of work into the pedagogy. If I take a random one, this is statistics that's being taught by two San Jose State professors and Let's see if we get in here. The other professors. This is a... here's Ron teaching this class.
Welcome to Statistics, the Science of Decisions. But before we get started with the class, Sean, Katie, and I wanted to talk to you a little bit about what our expectations are for you and what you should expect to
learn. So they go into like random points, and I have no clue what I'm going to hear. Obviously, I haven't really taken the class. Say lesson five, whatever lesson five is. What you find is, okay, cake will be served, I see. We have a latency problem specifically here right now. You'd see that this is, on the top bar is the class, the orange dot, and each of these little dots is a quiz. So here's a typical thing.
What about for Andy? How many standard deviations is Andy's number of Twitter followers below the mean number of Twitter followers?
So you take problems that kids can relate to, like Twitter followers, and then we have these quizzes, and these quizzes are usually very hard. Some of them are textual, some of them are numerical, some of them are full mathematical expressions, some of them are theorems, some are program code. And I can submit my answer and get feedback. Sometimes the feedback is binary, you got it wrong. Often it's actually qualified where you get some more hints. In basic math, let's see if I can find my basic math classes again, course catalog. Here's college algebra, one of our classes, which is the GE algebra class, I guess. Math 8, it's called. It's kind of slow. We have like hundreds of quizzes, and the entire evolution of the material focuses around those quizzes. So if I take this class with Julie, who's a fantastic San Jose State professor, really great, you can go in and wait. And if you look at the top bar, you probably can't see it. There's quiz after quiz after quiz after quiz after quiz. Let me just pick a random one. Slow X and Y intercept. I have no clue what that is. But when I get there, there's typically a short test.
Which type of lines or types of lines cannot be written in this form we've just been talking about? Y equals MX.
And often students skip state of the quiz and do the quiz first. And when they've got the quiz wrong or right or wrong, they go and rewatch the instruction, and then they finally get it right. So that's kind of a flair of it. What I haven't really shown you is that some of our quizzes are really engaged. This is from our computer science classes, where the quiz is writing program code, and some of the code is really complicated. We have a computer science class that had more than 260,000 students, and it's a class Introduction to Computer Science by David Evans from University of Virginia. And in this class, the instructor gets you from no programming whatsoever to program your own search engine so you can build your own little Google. We feel it's important to put stuff into context, to give motivation that people care about. Building your own Google appeals to a certain number of people more than data structures and algorithms. So we figured we focus on problems that people really care about. We have a physics class where the first assignment or the first lecture or first unit is about measuring the circumference of the planet using a ruler and a clock. It turns out the Greeks did do this. They figured out it's round. The Catholics and the Christians forgot it for a few hundred years, but for a while it was known. And it turns out if you take basic trigonometry and sine and cosine, little bits of math, and a ruler and a clock, you can measure how big the planet is. And students all around the world get into this frenzy of measuring how big the planet is. Some traveled to Ecuador to the equator and took measurements there and exchanged those things. And there was this big mass movement of students really trying to explore how big the planet is. And as a side effect, they learned all about trigonometry and geometry and basic laws in the space. But they were highly motivated to do so. Now, that pedagogy is what we're trying to explore, what we're really after, because we believe that if we get the pedagogy right in this medium, we can really change the world and really bring learning to students that otherwise might be lost in the classroom. This is a Time magazine cover that focused on us. It actually evaluated a whole bunch of MOOCs and picked ours as the one they liked the best. So the entire cover story in October last year was about us. And Amanda Ripley, who wrote it, at some point writes, "What surprised me was the way the class was taught. It was designed according to how the brain actually learns. In other words, it had almost nothing in common with most classes I'd taken before." And this is not to kind of blame what we do in classrooms. In classrooms, we are forced to be synchronous. And by being forced to be synchronous, one instructor, many students, our repertoire is limited. And if we were able to afford a single professor per student, I think we could actually do better. In fact, shown so by Benjamin Bloom in the 1980s, in a famous paper called the Two Sigma Effect. But we can't afford doing it in the classroom. But in this online medium, there's a chance to go and revisit all this and make using the asynchronicity of online as a driving factor in coming up with very new pedagogies. And that's what I'm very excited about. Now, with San Jose State, we have a fantastic collaboration that started about half a year ago. We got all kinds of stakeholders together and asked the question, how can we use this new instrument, the MOOC? How can we evolve it further? But also, how can we bring it to the best benefit of the state of California? And this was all based on a phone call I received June 18th last year by Governor Brown, who out of the blue called me up and said, hey, I'm your governor. And I said, hi, I'm your citizen. And he said, look, we have a crisis in California. And I said, what? He said, my response was like too much taxes. Of course we have a crisis. But he said, no. We have over 470,000 students waitlisted that can't get in. We have an escalation of tuition costs. We have enormous retake rates. I think in the CSU system, about one CSU dedicated just to retakes, if you work out the math. We have a four-year degree takes 6 years. I read this article about you. Can you help us? And I said, of course I can. And then the next months of my life were dedicated to finding out how to help. And I talked to pretty much everybody. I talked to the CSU community colleges. I talked to the unions. I talked to all kinds of stakeholders, VAST, the accreditors, the state government, various foundations. And we put together this plan to try out, to bring this instrument of this massive online class to the benefit of California students. And rather than phrasing it as a competition to existing college, which I think is a really bad way to look at this, we looked at this as a way to enhance access. And who better to reach out to than high school students who generally come relatively unprepared to college? When you look at the rate of high school students who get stuck in remedial in the CSU system, it's close to 60%. So more than half of the students don't even benefit to enjoy college when they come here, but instead have to do remedial work, usually mathematics or English. So a question arose, can we help those students to get college ready? And can we give students a taste of college? Can we bring the equivalent of AP classes to high schools that can't even afford AP classes, like inner city classes? The governor had started a school called Oakland Military Institute, mostly black kids. Can we give those kids the same education that the super rich kids get at a super rich private high school by using this new medium? So we started with three classes. We now have five, most in mathematics and statistics, and try to bring them to those students. And to make sure that it's not just something for the super rich, we used the fact that we had certain savings and made the classes cheaper than they typically are in the CSU. We offering them for $150, and Bill and Melinda Gates came in and just paid all these $150 bills for all of our kids in the system, so it meant it'd be free. But we also said, well, rather than just making it a one free computer program, let's toss in human supervision and human mentoring. We had observed that the typical MOOC has a retention rate of about 3 to 5%, and we wanted to have a retention rate of 100%. So we ended up designing a fleet of tutors and mentors and others that sit there and work with students, help them through the program, and also available as a 24/7 helpline with those students, which is ongoing right now. So if you're one of those students, you would enjoy the benefits of this. And I can't really talk too much about results. There's a big discussion going on. The National Science Foundation is doing a study. But we have some very, very good data points. And one that we publicly discussed is in our statistics class, we were able to bring the retention rate up to 100% from 3.4% in the open MOOC by providing services around it. So part of this is for us to really find a model that we can bring out of the college to students who are not inside college and have them benefit from it. And in this specific case, accrue college credit. So when they hit college, they're done faster, they're more educated, and as a result, the CSU system should be able to graduate more students in total without increasing costs. And that's kind of great for the state of California, given that we vastly underserving our student population. We turn away many, many students, and many students go to neighboring states and study there because we have insufficient capacity. Now, one might take issue with this and say, well, if we just gave more money and fund our system better, we could educate all those students. But that's something that's way above my pay grade, where all these politics come in about like how much money is available and whom should given to, should be the prisons or the schools and so on. So I take no position there. But we certainly are inspired to help with technology and new teaching approaches to see if we can really help high school students to be more prepared. Now, I want to close my presentation before the QA session with some prediction about 2020. And 2020 is far enough out that we hopefully won't be bothered too much by it. But I have some aspirations about how education should be transformed. And these are much more global and fundamental observations. Here's my first one. The organization of life. From the good old days, pre-industrial revolution, we've learned that the first 5 years of life are dedicated to play. Actually, gets childhood is a more recent innovation. But then there's, today at least, a long phase of education all the way to age maybe 24. If you get a PhD, maybe age 48. And then there's a phase of work, and then there's a phase of rest followed by death. And that model is prevalent in higher education. That is, when we take students into higher education, we tend, there's not a time to for all your students, but many students, we tend to take them in full time. And then most importantly, when we're done with them, we give them a degree. And at elite institutions, the handshake that used to be like this changes to something like this. That to me is just exactly the wrong model for the 21st century. And we ought to change this. And this is going to have profound impacts on everything in higher education. Here's the correct model. And you can debate how thick these bars should be. Obviously, a three-year-old shouldn't be working on a conveyor belt. But I think play, educate, work, and rest should all be interleaved and interwoven. And specifically, educate is a lifelong endeavor, and not just a fixed-time endeavor. Educational companies, also known as universities, should be available to support us to our lifetime needs. It turns out every other industry does this already. So my cable company, my HMO, all of those support me through my entire life, except for my educational company, also known as university, which says, when you're done, goodbye. We have no service for you as you go through life. The reason why I think this is really important is hundreds of years ago, we lived in a world where between the time you were born and the time you died, almost nothing really changed. Now we live in a world where everything changes all the time. So hundreds of years ago, having a single phase of education was probably sufficient. Today it isn't. In my old field of computer science, almost everything that is important today did not exist 10 years ago. Like if you're a computer scientist, you know about this. It's probably true for your field as well. We didn't have mobile computing. We didn't have cloud services. We didn't have programming languages like Ajax and Ruby on Rails and what the names are. None of this stuff existed. And yet we're still under the illusion that a one-time education is the right solution for everybody. So what this medium will afford us, I think, is making education much more accessible. We can reach out to continuing education. In fact, we have a huge number of classes on our website right now built by companies that seem to want to bestow kids and people of all ages with the type of skills needed for the workforce. One example is Google has a class out on HTML5. HTML5 is the language by which you program your web browsers. Big deal. There's almost nothing in the industry you can do without HTML5. In fact, it's going to be the de facto standards for phones as well. So it's a huge, huge, huge labor opportunity, and almost no college teaches it. And even if colleges do teach it, if you've left college, you won't be able to get access to it. So we're making it available. We have over 58,000 students in this class right now, many in India, many in the United States. We can really close the gap. And this is an academic class. It's not just a skills class. It's about game design in a programming language. It's as good as most computer science classes. NVIDIA has a class on parallel programming using modern tools. Most parallel programming classes that I know of are very outdated and use tools that don't even exist anymore. So with this medium, we can really address this, in my opinion. There's many other things I think that will change and have to change, and we should really think about this. And they don't have to change tomorrow morning, but I think they're important because they really reflect developments in society we can't ignore. Or if we ignore them, we'd be less and less relevant. One is semester-long classes. The old formative semester made perfect sense when you really had to come to a physical campus and sit there with your professor in the same location. Much of today's learning doesn't take a semester, it takes one evening. When you go out and try to learn something, you typically don't enroll in the class, you go to Google and just learn it, okay? So we have to shorten the unit massively and give students more control of which units to pick and have a faster finishing time. It's almost as profound as the transition from like long letters to Twitter, which is really profound in my opinion. In the past, only professors could teach. I think everybody should be able to teach. The best students are the ones that teach, and the best way to learn the material is to teach it. When I say witchcraft to data-driven teaching, witchcraft might be the wrong word, but a lot of what I learned as an instructor was how to teach was based on rumors and observing my own professors teach. I would never had an instrument to help me understand how good my teaching really is. And I can tell you, when I looked at the scores of my Stanford students after AI class and saw them go up when I gave the online version relative to my in-class version, I was shocked that my regular classroom teaching wasn't as effective as what Salman Khan was effectively doing. This new medium will afford us to get instant data on our teaching performance and help us improve our teaching materials, not based on rumors or discussions, but just based on statistics, which I think is exactly the right way to go. If you doubt it, most modern companies like Netflix and Amazon massively use machine learning to tailor their websites to make you purchase more. We should use the same insights to tailor our educational materials and experiences to make the students learn more and better. Proactive learning versus just-in-time learning. A lot of learning that takes place today is proactive. We educate people very young in the hopes that the skills and knowledge might be needed later on. The world is changing to just-in-time, and the reason is information materials have become more accessible. We outsourced the human cultural brain from our physical brains into the internet. That means we can defer learning when it's more needed, when we are more motivated. I think we as institutions should understand this and really get into this to understand that a lot of learning takes place when people are highly motivated and needed. An example is I recently had to refinance a house. I'm not a refinance expert, but in no time, thanks to Google, I became a refinancing expert. And it was just in time. If I had taken a class in college on how to refinance a house, I probably would have long forgotten how to do this. And finally, the one size fits all, I think, is a myth that we are undergoing. We are obsessed with grouping people into cohorts based on age in K through 12. And we are obsessed in taking students on the journey at the same speed. What this new medium will give us is an ability to tailor the experience to individual students. And a good example is Go At Your Own Pace, has already taken place at Udacity and Khan Academy and others. But I think there's much more to it. I envision a medium that is smart enough to understand that you have a specific type problem in a specific subject area and takes you on a tour through the subject area so you can make up for the remedial work need in the specific sub area and then bring you back. And that's something that could never happen in a classroom, but it's beautifully done in the online world. As a result, I believe the online world has opportunities that go way beyond what we can do in classrooms. The comparison is certainly not a good comparison to make. I don't think we can compare theater and film and ask which one's better. Is it theater or film? I think both of them have their own strengths. But what I firmly believe is that this kind of education, if you take it seriously, if you're willing to experiment and engage, if you're willing to fail in experiments and get up and try it again, can really change pedagogy, can change access, and ultimately also will change costs for the students. Thank you so much.